Heritage Unbounded, a podcast series of the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program in the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences Advanced Academic Programs at Johns Hopkins University. Join us as we keep our finger on the pulse of heritage and our changing world. We will talk with leading heritage professionals in the field and discuss the biggest accomplishments and challenges of heritage today. We are joined today by a very special guest, Hanako Okutsky. And Hanako is actually a former student of mine and alum of the Museum Studies program at Johns Hopkins University. So I am thrilled to welcome Hanako to our conversation today. So welcome, Hanako.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm glad to be here.
Hanako just got a really wonderful new job at the National Park Service at the Honolulu National Historic Site in Honolulu, Hawaii. Tell us a little bit about this new site. I understand it's a new National Park Service site in Hawaii.
Yeah, so Honolulu National Historic Site was established in 2015. And so we're in the baby stages of developing this site as a park unit. So Honolulu was a Japanese American incarceration site during World War II that held Japanese Americans and Japanese nationals, as well as POWs. So over the course of its history, it had about 4,000 POWs that was brought in from the front lines and about 400 Japanese Americans. But its period of significance is definitely World War II, but it was specifically established for its history of the Japanese American incarceration during that time under the Obama administration. So this is part of a larger narrative that connects to all the sites on the mainland. A lot of people are familiar with Manzanar National Historic Site, Minidoka National Historic Site. Those were the mainland camps, which were War Relocation Authority sites. That was actually managed by Department of Interior starting in 1944. So that's why, in one aspect, it's kind of weird to be wearing this badge, which represents the Department of Interior, because my family was actually incarcerated at Manzanar. I had four generations of my family there. And now I'm part of the agency to preserve this history with the National Park Service. So there's a lot of connections with Honolulu. It was established to be the demonstration site of the 16 other units in Hawaii that incarcerated Japanese Americans. But we also want to make sure, you know, we preserve the POW experience as well as tell the story of the site itself and what the Native Hawaiian land used beforehand.
So for the 400 Japanese Americans that were incarcerated at the site, were they primarily from the state of Hawaii or were they moved from the mainland to the state?
Yeah, so they were all in the state of Hawaii. So with the other 16 sites, it was like KMC, Kilauea Military Camp on the Big Island, Maui Jail incarcerated some folks. There were several sites on Oahu. It's just at the time, Honolulu was a Department of Army site, and we happened to have the land going to be gifted to us or donated to us in 2015 that it seemed it was the most eligible kind of potential park unit that was then designated to then try to tell the story of all the other incarceration across the islands. But there is connections to the mainland camp where if people wanted to be incarcerated as a family, then they were sent through Angel Island to whether it was Topaz or Jerome in Arkansas. And then from there, they were also moved around to a lot of folks ended up at Gila River from Hawaii.
At this camp, then, you weren't incarcerated as a family unit? Was it split up by gender? How did that work?
So they did have women and male there, but they were separated in different facilities. They were there incarcerated as an individual. Most of them were teachers, language teachers, Buddhist priests, Shinto priestesses. So we had women who were incarcerated there. People who were deemed, and I'm using air quotes, as suspicious, because some folks, you know, as a child, they were sent back to Japan for education and brought back. They were known as kibis. And the government at the time thought that they were somehow untrustworthy. But if we fast forward to the 80s and looking back with 2020 vision, no one of Japanese ancestry was ever actually convicted of a crime. So there was actually no cases of conviction for espionage or sabotage, unlike the German and Italian American communities, where there were actual convictions that led to incarceration on the East Coast. That some people know about, so they tried to make an equivalent saying, well, don't forget about the German Americans and Italian Americans, they were incarcerated. But unlike Japanese Americans, it was a wholesale incarceration without due process.
Your family, Don, you mentioned earlier, were incarcerated on the mainland. As a family unit, you mentioned four generations.
Yeah, that's correct. So my family was living in Southern California. So I had a great-great-grandmother who was living with my great-grandparents. They were taken from their homes on Terminal Island, and then they ended up moving with my grandparents in Santa Monica. But my great-grandfather was taken away because he was a fisherman. So he was, air quotes, suspicious to the government. They thought that he was dumping oil for Imperial Japanese submarines. And he's like, no, I'm a fisherman. I dump chum. That's how I get mackerel. But he was taken away to a Department of Justice facility. So there were many different facilities that were out there, like over, I want to say it's over 50 different types of sites, maybe probably closer to 100. And so my family actually got split up. But my grandfather at least had the foresight to at least keep his mother, his grandmother, and then his children together. So we were under one family number. And then they were taken to Santa Anita Racetrack and then to Manzanar. So my grandfather ended up getting drafted out of camp to fight for the United States for this notion of freedom, which his family did not have at the time. And so these are the civil liberties themes that we talk about of, you know, what does it mean to be American? And how do you reconcile that where, in one aspect, we're not seen American enough to be trustworthy, but yet we are called upon to be American enough to die for the country? And where does those lines, like, where are those lines? Because my grandfather wanted to prove loyalty and wanted to enlist into the military. But by the time my great-grandfather was reunited with the family, it was kind of broken down. The FBI kind of, you know, broke him when he was at Fort Lincoln, and he became back a little bit abusive and alcoholic. And so they had an argument over it. And so my great-grandfather was like, I don't want you to die before you have to. And so he was telling my grandfather about, you know, whether to enlist or not. And so they came to an agreement that they would just wait until he gets drafted out of camp rather than volunteering. And so my grandfather ended up going into the military intelligence service and helped out with the occupation of Japan afterwards. But then he was originally drafted into the 522, which was an artillery division, which it was pulled out before the division went out, but that division ended up becoming the first unit to get to the outer camps of Dachau to liberate it. And not a lot of people know about that story because they were told to hold back until their white counterparts came in. And that story didn't come out until, I want to say 15 or 20 years ago, when there was a researcher who found this gentleman named Suis Ito who took pictures of that instance when they were liberating the camp. But they were told to keep it quiet.
Wow, that's a very interesting history. So, you know, having such a personal connection to this history, this piece of history, did you seek out those opportunities to be able to share that history with others? Or was it happenstance that sort of brought you to the Park Service sites that were related to that?
Yeah, it was more happenstance at first. When I was at Boise State University for my undergrad, one of my mentors to be reached out to me because he recognized my last name. And so my great aunt wrote Farewell to Manzanar, just kind of a big, like a coming of age book for Japanese Americans to talk about the incarceration. It was one of the first books to discuss it outside of Mina Okubo's book that came out in the 40s. And so somehow he found out that I was there. He reached out to me and said, hey, I want to do some programming. Do you know about Minidoka? And I actually did not know about Minidoka, which was a facility in Idaho that incarcerated people, because I knew about my immediate family being at Manzanar. And so I lied to him and said yes, because he was a former dean of my college. And then I Googled it and I was like, holy cow, this is really messed up. And so he got me involved with the Friends of Minidoka, and then eventually some Park Service representatives requested, hey, do you want to work in this kind of work? Then from there, I applied for a position at Tule Lake over in Northern California. And then I found out that I had one of my aunties, her side of the family went through Tule Lake and then still stayed engaged, went to the Navy, then got recruited back to Minidoka, and then found out that I had other people on my great-grandmother's side of the family was at Minidoka. It was really interesting finding out new connections to these sites, because I've been working with Minidoka National Historic Site for, at the time, like at least 9 or 10 years, and I I didn't know I actually had the family connections there. So with Honolulu, I kind of now pigeonholed myself in a very specific history of Japanese American incarceration history. And I did seek out this assignment because I really want to tell this story in a meaningful way that contextualizes it and allows us to try to heal as a community, not only as a Japanese American community, but the American community as a whole. Because there's so much misinformation out there where people just only want to look through the lens of World War II, but not contextualize the history of all the anti-Asian sentiment that led to this occurring and what occurred afterwards. Because even at Minidoka, I want to say about 4 times a year, I'm called a JAP. I think most of it's just out of ignorance. I don't think that people are trying to hurt me. There's a lot of microaggressions and macroaggressions where they're like, oh, you must have gotten this job because you're Japanese. Well, no, I was actually qualified. So, but then on top of that, you get people who are like, this is revisionist history. And I'm like, well, you know, when we're looking at the documentation with the 2020 lens, we could have a better understanding of what actually occurred. And one of the things that people don't like to hear about is those actually 2 major studies, the Office of Naval Intelligence and the FBI, that essentially said we don't need to do a mass incarceration of Japanese Americans on the West Coast because the government was watching them since the 30s. And they already taken people who they thought were a suspect. But all of those 2 pieces of evidence got suppressed, which ended up allowing this to happen. And that's why, you know, it's really important for our interpretive themes, at least at Minidoka, to talk about the civil liberties and civil rights violation where there was no due process.
That context piece is such an important part of that story. And there have been, as we know, an increased wave of crimes against Asian American community in the United States. So I'm wondering if you can talk about some of those historical lessons that you've learned from your work at those sites that are relevant to what's happening today and can help us think about and work through some of the events of today.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if we start back in the past and look at things contextually, you know, you had the Page Act that limited Asian women to immigrate. Then you had the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 that just excluded any Chinese immigrants, even though at one point in time, we welcomed Asian immigrants in to help build the infrastructure of the United States, like the Transcontinental Railroad, help with the mining, and all these other labor-intensive work. But it's very similar today. Some people are like, hey, there are people coming in. Oh, they look different. They don't, what's the right word? Like, they're not assimilating is a tag word, right? But how could people assimilate into a culture if they're being rejected? Because at the time, there wasn't housing laws or anything like that. They're like, we don't want you to live here. So people created their own communities, those Chinatowns. So they weren't integrating in the community. But then the local community members are like, how come they're over there? Why aren't they speaking our language? But they don't have those same opportunities. So you get these arguments where people are really upset about these other groups that are trying to come in to establish a life, but yet they're not accepted in the community. But because of that, they're being ostracized, right? So you have all these federal policies that were created because later on, there was a thing called the Cable Act. I'm not sure if you're aware, but that is where it was mostly directed towards Asian immigrants, where if a woman was an American citizen and married someone who is not a U.S. citizen, they would lose their citizenship status. And I haven't heard that of any of white folks dealing with this, but definitely within the Asian community, you would see people who were born in the United States who lost their citizenship. And we found this out when we're doing research for this memorial that we're creating at Minidoka for an exhibit, where we're like, wow, there's a lot more immigrants, what we call the Issei, the first generation. But then when we're actually looking at where people were born, a lot of them were born in Seattle and Portland, but they lost their citizenship because they happened to marry someone who was the Japanese national. Because it wasn't until the 50s where Asian Americans could actually become naturalized citizens. There were several different lawsuits that went to the Supreme Court. There was a Singh one and then Ogawa versus the United States to try to get citizenship, but then they weren't seen as whites. So they weren't allowed to. So, you know, those happened in the 1900s, 1920s or so. And then you have all the anti-Asian sentiment slowly building up that led to World War II and the incarceration, because a lot of people, they don't want to understand that it was Imperial Japan that attacked Pearl Harbor. It wasn't just the Japanese. When we talk about World War II on the European front, we at least distinguish that there's Nazi Germany, there's fascist Italy, right? But Japan is always Japan. And I think that that's what confuses people in the narrative, where they're just like, they're Japanese, all Japanese people are somehow complicit in this crime. But how ridiculous would it sound if we said any German American during World War II was complicit in the Holocaust? That's the equivalence that is being made, because that's actually, if I was to hear that's like, no, that's ridiculous, that did not happen, you know, because it was a government versus the people. Right. And so understanding that, and to learn that, to help shed a lot of these emotional ties that are the storytelling over the years have connected, that all Japanese were somehow complicit, because you still hear the narrative. I hear people coming in saying, oh, you know, they're Japanese, we didn't know, we had to do it for military necessity. It's like, no, there's a thing called intelligence, and our government's actually really good with that, that dictated that. So, you know, when we now see how this has occurred throughout the years, we have the Vincent Chin incident that occurred, and being Asian American, you know, we are a visible minority and always kind of tagged as the perpetual foreigner in one aspect, that we need to be vigilant about it. We need to understand our history, because if you look at it, we're kind of following the same path that the government has, in a sense, institutionalized a lot of these policies that leads to this reaction from the public, and understanding that is really important. So some of my work with the White House Initiative on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, we are working with the administration on some of their priorities, which one of them, President Biden put out an executive order on January 21st on condemning and combating racism, xenophobia, and intolerance against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in the United States. So with some of the programs that we're doing there for especially Asian American Pacific Islanders Heritage Month, which is in May, we are doing some of these programs to bring this to light.
Can you tell us, Hanako, a little bit about some of the interpretive techniques you're planning to use for the new park? So, I mean, I guess this is ground up, right? The land's being donated. It's a new designation. And so are there existing structures on place? What are you guys, how are you going to approach that interpretation?
There are some extant foundations and structures on site. Some of them are related to World War II, some of them aren't, because eventually after the incarceration, they put out a lot of guinea grass, which is actually an invasive species, for filming out there to create that jungle look. And so there's some props that are out there still from that time. But we're still trying to figure out how are we going to preserve this history? Because within the Park Service, we go through several planning processes. So first was our special resource study that says, okay, what's the period of significance? What are we trying to do at this site? Then we went through a foundation document where this is the foundational information that we need to talk about, right? And now we're in preparation. We just completed our preliminary planning process, which we call for shorthand P3, which identifies the planning documents that we need before we can move forward to a general management plan. So we have identified a few things that we're trying to work on, like access and whatnot. And hopefully in a year or two, we could actually get towards our general management plan. And that is where we reach out to our communities that we serve, to other stakeholders, to be like, how would you like this site to be developed? What kind of things would you like to see? Because it makes sense, you know, we're going to talk about the incarceration experience, we're going to talk about the POW experience as well. But what are those things? What are the universal concepts that we're going to get at? And they're going to come up with some broad aspects during this time for the general management plan. And then after that's completed, the general management plan would actually be our 20-year document on how we were going to plan out the site. So most of the time that would identify those larger themes. It will identify, what kind of staffing structure. It would identify, these are what we would like to see, whether it's a visitor center or trails. But we don't do this in a vacuum. We do it with our community buy-in, because this isn't just National Park Service is doing something on our own. It's no, we are reaching out to community because this belongs to Americans, right? So we want folks to provide their input to develop the site. But afterwards, then we'll create a long-range interpretive plan that would deal with a lot of breaking down those themes into sub-themes. So then anything that we do would always refer back to that. But I do see that, there's always going to be that civil liberties kind of theme tied into that. And then the general World War II, like, how does this fit in everything else? Because it is a very unique site with the POWs as well being brought in. We could connect that to so many other stories on the mainland where those actually POW camps where the POWs did labor, but out here they weren't doing labor, as I understand.
I just recently heard a statistic about tourism in Hawaii, and that a significant number of tourists to the island are actually from Asia. Do you guys suspect that will be a big visitor base for you as well?
Yes, we do see a high Asian population coming in for tourism out here. I'm currently sitting at Pearl Harbor National Memorial, where I just completed a detail as their chief of interp or acting chief of interp over the last 4 months. And a lot of our visitation is tourism. A lot of it is foreign tourism. But right now, because of COVID, things are a little bit more restricted, that we are not seeing as many foreign visitors because of the restriction of going back to their home countries after coming to the United States. There's, heavy quarantine status. But that is something that we do anticipate, is that there's been a huge interest in Honolulu'uli and understanding this history and how it fits into the larger narrative. So we'll see how that all kind of pans out.
What an interesting site. I'm really eager to see how it gets developed. I have never been to Hawaii, so I will put it on my list, Hanako, for when the site opens. I will come and visit.
Yeah, and there's several parks across the islands, right? There's I think 7 on the Big Island or 5 on the Big Island, and then we got 2 out here and Maui with Haleakala. So yeah, make a big trip out of it.
I will. I'll make a big trip of it. So you mentioned a little bit about the White House Initiative on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders.
So with the White House Initiative on Asian American Pacific Islanders, we shorthand call it WIAPI, just to make it easier. So at WIAPI, it's basically made up of a lot of federal agencies coming together to try to showcase the programs that each agency has for our different constituency groups and how they're able to connect. So in the past, I was the regional lead for Region 10, which is Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. And before that, under the Obama administration, I was the Region 9 lead of Southern California, Arizona, Nevada, and Hawaii. So some of the different programs that we do is to, again, connect people with the resources. So we did a media event one time in Los Angeles where we did in-language programming. And we had the FBI, we had the IRS, Department of Labor, Social Security Office, to be like, hey, these are the programs that we have. Did you know that these programs existed, and this is how you could get involved? But there was also other kind of good informational programming that we did as well, because with Department of Labor, I always think about Department of Labor as, it's unemployment, that's it. But there are gun-carrying agents within Department of Labor that are dealing with other inequities of slave labor and sweatshops and all that stuff. And so learning about the programs that exist there was really interesting. And Asian immigrants are one of the largest immigrant groups coming in, that there was actually a program that they were hosting to let workers know what rights they have, whether they're American citizens and whether they're in the service industry or not. And then if they're not American citizens, what if they're undocumented, overstayed their visa? visa, what rights do they have? Because sometimes employers would take advantage of their employees by saying, you know, by threatening them, like they'll turn you in or whatnot. But there are some rights that people have. And so they were doing this whole education campaign to be like, hey, so this is what you can and can't do. And these are your rights that you have. If you're being mistreated, call this number. And so it's a way to get people to understand, you know, we have programs to help folks out. And I know that sometimes people get afraid when it's like, hi, I'm from the federal government. People are like, ah, but, you know, we do have programs that are they're meant to help people. And we're just trying to showcase that. This happened to focus on the Asian American Pacific Islanders community. But most of the time is when we're doing these programs, anyone's invited. It's just we want to target this group because they are underserved. Sometimes programming isn't directed towards the community that I live in. So we're just trying to find ways to get information into different communities so people know what's available within the government realm.
I wasn't aware of that initiative. And so it sounds like you guys do some really good work. And I love to see that folks from the Park Service and folks with a heritage and museum background are included in that group as well, because that's such, as we talked about before, such an important piece that contacts and understanding that historical development of our social relations. That's a really important piece to all of navigating today as well. So that's really great to see. Usually here at the end, we wrap it up where you can offer some words of hope and encouragement and where you see the direction of Heritage Field moving. So is there anything you want to share with the audience?
Yeah, I guess there's a few things that I would like to share. One is, if you're very interested in this field, it is kind of an uphill battle, and you have to be realistic about your expectations and understand that this field is oversaturated with applicants. So you need to find ways to get in. Sometimes I get a little disappointed where people are just like, oh, I've been trying to get a job, blah, blah, you know, and I get it. It's hard out there. So if this is a career path that you want, you need to figure out how you want to get there and have different strategies. With me, I was definitely already in the museum field, but my undergrad, I had to work a lot of free internships just to get my foot in the door. And I worked for the local historical society, but I took a risk to leave the state ran historical society, to go to the feds. The feds does pay a little bit better than in the normal museum realm, but going into Department of Interior, specifically in the Park Service, again, it's oversaturated with applicants. So if that's a way you want to go, you need to then find creative strategies to get around. So my way was going to Department of Navy, and from there, getting my permanent status to lateral back in. And it does kind of suck if you do have a family and if you can't move around, but those are kind of the realities. If you want to find a job, at least in the federal service, you have to move around to move up. But there's great opportunities once you get past that. Some people want to be educators. Some people just want to do the visitor services. Some people want to go into curation. Within the Park Service, there are ways to wear multiple hats, and it's very fulfilling and rewarding. But we also underpay compared to other federal agencies. When I was working with the Navy, the stuff that I'm doing right now, it's crazy. I'm pretty sure being like two promotions ahead is what I would get paid than what I'm getting paid now. But it is so rewarding to be part of an agency that has a good mission, a mission that I could stand up behind and feel good about. And they're willing to look in the mirror to be like, hey, we as a nation understand that there are some black marks in history, but we need to own up to it. And even that Department of Interior was part of the oppressing agency at the time. There's value in that if you're willing to stick with it, but also just know where your lines are. Don't get abused in a system. I don't want to say you have to deal with all this stuff to get your foot in the door. It's like, no. You also deserve to have respect for yourself and figure out where that line is. And there's other ways to fulfill that need, whether it's by volunteering, but you have to watch out for yourself. So just don't get caught in that trap where you feel like you have to keep on doing these things for the sake of your career if it's not working out financially. So yeah, so with the future of heritage, the heritage movement and preservation, I think that there's a lot of possibilities out there because the government is starting to recognize them. And I think the American people is starting to recognize the importance of preserving history that isn't necessarily settled in within the white heteronormative landscape, right? And understanding that is really important. And I think it's good that we're moving to actually preserve history that represents all of America. And if we could be part of this movement, that's fantastic. And understanding what are your biases and, you know, implicit bias, and making sure you have the cultural competencies needed, or you're at least seeking out those competencies to move forward. Because there's a lot of stuff that's going on that we may not be able to see. I don't understand certain privileges that other people have just from my experience growing up. But then I'm also deconstructing a lot of the internalized racism, because I grew up in Idaho. So there is a lot of that that I have to personally deconstruct and get out of me as well. So we're all in different areas of personal growth, but understanding that we have to have a growth mindset so we could become better, so we could create and preserve this history for future generations. Because if we don't understand our past, how are we going to create our future? So we need to have that understanding to move forward. So if this is a passion for you, keep on going if you're able to go, but just make sure you're not taken advantage of.
Wonderful advice, Hanako. And, you know, coming off of COVID and as things start to sort of open up again, we all know that the heritage and museums have been significantly impacted and impacted in more ways than some other sectors. And so I know there are a lot of emerging professionals in the field that feel the weight of that piece. And so, you know, I love that you said to also respect themselves and to know, not be taken advantage of, and to sort of know where those limits are. Thank you for that. That was great advice for them moving forward. So this has been absolutely wonderful to chat with you today. It really has. And it's great to see all the wonderful stuff that you have done and where you're going. And now I guess I'm actually on record saying that I'm going to come to Hawaii when your park opens. So you'll have to hold me to it. So thank you very much, Hanako.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I hope you all enjoyed listening.
Spread the word and invite your friends, and join us again next time for another episode of Heritage Unbounded, brought to you by the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program and the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences Advanced Academic Programs, Johns Hopkins University. Podcast music features the piano instrumental Gonzaga Gaucho by Mark Staub.